Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levenier. In this hour, true history, later on, the passing parade, and the program that was the year, but first, radio's own show. As they build themselves, it's Behind the Mic, an NBC Blue Network broadcast from November 24th, 1940.
Radio's own show, Behind the Mic. Radio. With a switch of a dial, radio brings you tragedy, comedy, entertainment, information, education, a whole world at your command. But there are stories behind radio, stories behind your favorite program and favorite personalities and radio people you never hear of. Stories as amusing, dramatic, and as interesting as any make-believe stories you hear on the air. And that's what we give you. The human interest, the glamour, the tragedy, the comedy, and information that are behind the mic. And now, presenting a man whose name, since the beginning of broadcasting, has been a byword in radio, Graham McNamee.
Thank you, Gil Martin, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. We've said that there's plenty of human interest behind the mic. And if you still have to be convinced, just listen to this story told by the singing star of the Eddie Cantor program and one of radio's favorite songsters, Dinah Shore. Dinah, will you tell our behind-the-mic audience that story about the truck driver who was such a fan of yours?
Well, Graham, he was a fan of mine who had often written requests for songs. I got the details of this story through a letter which he wrote me. Here's the story the letter told.
Dear Miss Shore, I want to tell you about something that happened to me. As I've written to you before, I'm an independent trucker. I own just one truck. A few days ago, I was bringing up a truckload of perishable goods from Florida to New York. I had a time limit in which to deliver the stuff or lose a contract that I needed badly. 2 days from New York, my helper came down with some awful stomach cramps, and I had to leave him in a hospital. I took the wheel myself. I'd been driving for about 40 hours without getting any sleep because, as I told you, I had to get my truckload to New York in that time limit. Keeping that contract meant a great deal to me because my business was in pretty bad shape. Gee, I'm tired. Boy, what I wouldn't give for a little snooze right now.
Hey, you big lug, why don't you look where you're going?
Maybe I could pull up beside the road here and grab a little shut-eye for just a few minutes. Nope. Can't do that. If I ever start sleeping, I won't wake up till tomorrow. Gee, I'm tired. I gotta do something to keep awake. I'll try tuning on the radio.
Now we bring you the voice of Dinah Shore, one of radio's favorite
singing
stars.
Dinah Shore. Last time I wrote her, she promised to sing I Dream of Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair for me tonight. Very interesting. I wonder if she will.
Dinah opens her program by singing I Dream of Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair.
Say, she is going to sing it. Good girl, Dinah. Boy, I got to stay awake to hear this.
Jeannie with a light brown hair, born like a vapor on the summer air. I see her tripping where the bright streams play. Happy as the daisies that dance on her way, many genie with a light brown hair, floating like a vapor on the soft summer air. I dream of Jeannie with a light brown hair.
Yes, that was an eye-opener. But gee, I feel sort of awake now. Let's see. 4 more hours and I'll be in. Thanks, Dinah. I feel like I just got up. I won't have no trouble from now on.
And did he reach New York okay and on time, Dinah?
Well, Grammy wrote me the letter. That ought to prove it.
Well, thank you, Dinah Shore, for a great story and, of course, always for your fine singing. The sound effect of the week. Each week, Behind the Mic presents some unusual sound effect which was used on a program of the past week and tells exactly how it was done. On the Bishop and the Gargoyle program this past week, this sound effect was used to denote a character being placed under a guillotine and having his head bobbed. I think it was the hero's hobby. This jovial sound effect was accomplished by the sound man on the Bishop and Gargoyle show, running a piece of metal up and down the side of a door to produce the sound of a guillotine knife falling. And then to complete the picture, taking a padded mallet and hitting the side of a wicker basket. There she goes. Ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon we're going to let you in on something that is really unusual and genuinely behind the mic. A young man, a member of the NBC guide staff, wants to try out for an NBC announcer's job, and he's going to do it on this program. We have the chief of the NBC announcer's department here, Pat Kelly, to give him the announcer's test. Pat Kelly. Hello, Pat. Hello, Pat, before we proceed with the audition, please tell our listeners what experience a man must have in order to become an NBC announcer.
Well, Graham, to get on a New York station, he has to have at least 2 years professional announcing experience. To get a job in one of our out-of-town stations, he has to have at least 6 months announcing experience and, of course, the qualifications we think necessary to make a good radio announcer.
When you test your announcers before giving them jobs, Pat, what do you look for?
Graham, the boys are judged on personality, voice, showmanship, their ability to project personality through the loudspeaker, and the ability to think fast and to describe events as they occur. They should also be able to read with style and without conveying the impression that they're reading in an artificial way. The tests that we will give our would-be announcer this afternoon are designed to cover these qualifications.
We have our candidate here at the microphone, the NBC guide whose regular job is showing visitors through a studio and who is now going to try for an announcer's job on one of our out-of-town stations. He's ready to proceed with the audition, and this is an actual test. Are you ready to listen to him, Pat?
Yes, Graham. But before I go into the control room to listen to him, let me say, ladies and gentlemen, that as his first test, our candidate will tell about himself and his background to enable us to hear his voice and to get an idea of his ability to sell himself. Because we feel that a man who cannot sell himself could not sell a commercial product or the program he's announcing. Now, I'll go into the control room, Graham, and will you describe the audition for our listening audience?
All right, Pat. Now, Bill Huck, Mr. Kelly is ready to listen to you. It's going to be tough, but the best of luck. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking to you for the purpose of trying to become associated with your announcing staff. Before proceeding with the audition, I should like to tell you of my qualifications and experience as an announcer. I attended Duke University, where I was a member of Duke Players, the dramatic organization on the campus, and of Theta Alpha Phi, National Honorary Dramatic Fraternity. I graduated from Duke with a Bachelor of Arts degree in economics. Having had some experience on a smaller station, I felt further and more valuable experience could be gained by coming to New York and the center of the radio industry, the National Broadcasting Company. The announcing class here at NBC has been of great value to me because I have learned how to read on the air, how to pronounce difficult foreign words, and in general, the requirements of a good radio announcer. But now, after this resume of my qualifications, we'll go on with the audition.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next test is designed to show the candidate's adaptability to different types of sustaining and commercial continuity and news copy. First, he will read a commercial of the punch type.
If hot weather or household cleaning wears you out, I'll tell you how thousands of other women keep fresh and happy. For your fault may lie with what you use to clean. You may be working too hard with an ordinary, lazy, inactive cleanser. So instead of cleaning this hard way, I urge you to switch to the amazing, quick-acting cleaner 2 million women now use.
And now the next commercial is to be read in a conversational style.
My buddy, my buddy. Nobody quite so true. This program is in honor of the most loyal buddy you will ever have, your dog. Presenting Dog Heroes, thrilling stories about heroic American dogs. Sponsored by the makers of the wonderful health-aiding food for dogs.
For our next test, Bill Huck is going to read a news bulletin to see how well he can handle this type of copy. Here's your bulletin, Bill.
Here's the latest news from the United Press. Athens. The Greek war ministry claims the Greek advance continues on all fronts. Vast stores of war materials are reported captured from the retreating Italian forces. And Athens claims Greek cavalry and British planes are spreading panic among the fleeing columns. London. German long-range guns shelled the Dover area for more than an hour this afternoon. No damage or casualties are reported. This news is from the United Press. Further details will be found in your newspapers.
And now for the final test, Bill Huck is to introduce a musical program and prove his ability to ad-lib, an ability every announcer must have, by describing the studio from which the broadcast is taking place.
Ladies and gentlemen, we continue now with our musical program, which is coming to you today from the Ritz Theater in New York. And before introducing the first number, I should like to tell you something of our surroundings here. This theater is located on 48th Street, just west of Broadway and New York's famous Times Square. This is not one of New York's largest theaters, being conventional one, though, having the usual balcony, boxes on either side, and the orchestra, which today is mostly full and provides accommodation for approximately 750 people. But now, to get back to our program, which features another one of NBC's famous musical aggregations, Ernie Watson and his orchestra. NBC listeners have frequently heard the works of such celebrated composers as Bach, Gounod, Mascagni, Mussorgsky, and many other masters of classic music. However, today, Ernie Watson brings you Love Is.
Well, that finishes the audition, and here comes Pat Kelly to give you his criticism, Bill.
Well, I suppose you'd like to know about the audition, Bill.
I certainly would, Mr. Kelly.
Okay, then. I'll give you my frank opinion, if you don't mind.
Not a bit.
I made a few notes while I was listening to you out in the booth. I find that your voice is satisfactory, though, of course, a little voice training wouldn't do you any harm. It would develop a richer quality, particularly in your chest tones. However, the voice is not the most important thing. It's no more important than having a violin. You can give a man a violin, he's still not a violinist. Give a man a voice, he's still not an announcer. But I think you have the vocal qualifications for announcing. Your enunciation and pronunciation, your articulation are all good, though you do have a tendency to slur final consonants. For example, watch words like speaking. There is a G on the end. Your salesmanship, commercial punch. You have punch all right, but I think with a little practice and experience, you will be able to make it a little more convincing than it was. Your conversational copy, reading of commercial conversational copy, I mean. You lack the ability to get sentiment into that little my buddy, my buddy. However, I'd rather you avoid sentiment than to try too hard and get sentimentality. Further practice, training will help that. In ad lib, you have the ability to put words together and to make a fairly conclusive picture. In other words, you have what an announcer must have, the ability to keep the show going. And I think you'll make good. And I hope in the very near future, we'll find a position for you as NBC announcer here in New York someday.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you both, Pat Kelly and Bill Huck, for giving us a real behind-the-mic scene. And boy, I'm mighty glad such tests were not in vogue when I broke into radio. Behind the Mic salutes a program you loved. We in radio believe that radio has a tradition of which it can well be proud. A tradition of good programs that linger fondly in our memory. And so each week, we bring you a star or a part of a program you used to hear. A program you loved. This afternoon, Behind the Mic salutes one of radio's most famous orchestras, Harry Horlick and his A&P Gypsies, which was on the air for 10 years from November 1926 to September 7th, 1936. We will recreate part of the A&P Gypsies program with leader Harry Horlick himself, leading the orchestra in arrangements that made his music famous. Harry Horlick and the A&P Gypsies.
You are listening to the familiar two guitars, the title of the composition with which the A&P Gypsies greet you each Monday evening. The Gypsies are here, ready and waiting to begin their hour of entertainment.
From listeners. Each week we invite the listeners to Behind the Mic to write us questions about radio, and the three or four we consider to be of most general interest, we have answered on the air by the radio editor of some outstanding magazine or newspaper. This afternoon's questions will be answered by Mr. Mel Spiegel, radio editor of the New York Morning Telegraph. Mr. Ralph Vogel of the Bronx, New York, asks this question. I listen a great deal to European broadcasts, and I would like to know if you can tell me when was the first transatlantic broadcast to regular radio listeners and from where did it originate?
Well, Graham, the first transatlantic broadcast originated from Coventry, England. It was picked up at Ulton, Maine, and transmitted by wire to WJZ in New York and from where it was broadcast. This first transatlantic broadcast was in 1924.
L.A. Carroll of Beverly Hills, California, writes in to ask this question about firsts. I had an argument with a friend as to what was the first coast-to-coast broadcast and when was the event broadcast. Will you please let me know?
The first coast-to-coast hookup was on January the 1st, 1927, and consisted of a broadcast of the Rose Festival Parade and the Rose Bowl football game from California.
Yeah, and I had the pleasure of being at the mic all that day, Mel. One of my real radio thrills. Miss Dorothea McCann of Darlington, Maryland, asked this. How is it that a star can appear on his own show, as Jack Benny did recently, and then right after that appear, as he did, on the Screen Guild show, which is on a different network?
Well, the reason Jack Benny was able to appear on these two programs, which followed each other on different networks, is that the NBC and the CBS studios in Hollywood, California, from where both shows originated, are right next to each other. As you remember, Jack did not appear in the first few minutes of the second show, which gave him time to travel from one building to another.
Thank you, Mel Spiegel, for answering those questions. Ladies and gentlemen, the scene of our true Behind the Mic story today is in a dressing room of an NBC studio on Thursday evening in June of 1934. It's an hour before the opening broadcast of the famous Maxwell House Showboat. The two blackface comedians of the show, Molasses and January, whom you all remember, and whose real names are Pat Paget and Pick Malone, are sitting in their dressing room near the studio. They are in the middle of giving their script a final reading.
Well, 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 doggone my time, molasses, old fraternity sister. How is your little dog getting along?
January, you mean my dog Corset?
Boy, why you call that dog Corset?
Because I keep him tied up all day and lets him out at night.
Oh, quick.
Think that's going to numb him.
It sure will, boy. Well, come on now, let's get along with this.
Okay, next line's yours.
All right, now here I go. Okay. Tell me this, yeah. How's you getting along with your E-flat fiddle-footed gal's papa, molasses?
Well, they don't let me in the house no more, because last time I was there, I got in a fight with a papa and stepped on his pipe.
Well, what's the matter with the man? I don't see why he should be so mad with you. There ain't nothing so terrible about stepping on the old man's pipe.
Yeah, but this was his windpipe.
That's all right, boy. That is funny. You know, this looks like a good script tonight.
Yeah, I think that windpipe gag is a great kicker.
It's a killer.
Let's go out and get a cup of coffee.
Yeah, well, all right. Now, wait till I wash up a little bit, will you?
Okay.
Oh, say, by the way, how's your wife getting along, Pat?
Oh, not so good, Pete. Ever since she had that operation of hers, she hadn't come along the way I hoped she would.
Oh, well, boy, now listen, don't worry about that. That Arizona air is great. It's going to fix her up all right.
Well, I sure hope it does. I got a letter from the doctor a few days ago and really got me worried.
Oh, well, now, wait a minute. There's no use in worrying about it, Pat, old boy. Listen, you know doggone well that Diane's going to be all right.
I sure hope.
I'll bet you'll be having her back with you before very long. Now, you wait and see. Now, wait till I get this soap out of my eyes here, and we'll go grab a cup of wrench down.
Okay. Come in.
Telegram for you, Mr. Padgett.
Telegram? Well, thanks, sir.
Yeah, boy.
Oh. Oh, Pick.
What? What's the matter? What is it, Pat?
Diane.
What?
She passed away in her sleep a little while ago.
Oh, gee. Gee, I'm sorry, Pat.
I can't believe it. Just don't seem possible, son.
I know.
Oh, Pick, I'm going to miss her.
Yeah, I know. That's all right. I know you will, sure. But I'll be right back in a minute, Pat, old boy.
Huh? Where are you going?
Well, I'm going out and find out about the trains. You want to catch the first train out there that gets out there, don't you?
Oh.
I'll be right back. Now, wait a minute. I'm going to tell Bill Batcher that we won't be on the program tonight.
Yeah, yeah, go on. Oh, wait a second, Pat.
Yeah,
wait,
what
wait.
Is it?
Pick, come here.
What?
Don't do that, son. We got 8 minutes of material in this show.
I know.
Well, they won't be able to fill that in without messing up the whole program.
Oh, but listen, wait a minute, Pat.
No, listen.
You can't... Listen.
It can't do any good whether I'm there a few hours earlier or later.
I know.
She wouldn't have wanted it any other way anyhow. She was in show business herself.
I know that.
If it'd do her any good, I wouldn't go on this show or any show ever. But it won't. It won't do nobody any good.
Oh, but Pat, now, really, you don't think you'll be able to go out there and...
Diane. Pick, listen.
Yeah?
Listen, son, don't tell this to anybody till after the show.
All right, boy, I won't say nothing.
And when the Maxwell House showboat went on that night...
And now, Molasses and January!
Yes. Don't go my time, Molasses, you fiddle-flooded E-flat ape, you. How you getting along with that farm of yours?
We had a little explosion on my farm yesterday.
An explosion? How was that?
Well, I fed a chicken some layer bus feed.
You fed the chicken some layer bus feed?
Yeah.
Well, how come the explosion?
She turned out to be a rooster.
Well, no wonder. Say, I hear you get up very early down on that farm of yours.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, 5 o'clock in the morning.
Uh-huh.
That's a.m.
Mm-hmm.
How come you get up so early?
I use a parrot and an alarm clock.
A parrot and an alarm clock?
Yeah.
Do the alarm clock wake you up?
No, sir. But the alarm clock wakes the parrot up. Boy, what that parrot say wake anybody up.
Yeah, well, boy, that's unusual, you know it?
I should smother two reflex.
Yeah.
I got another little pet out there.
Yeah, what's that?
A whiff sniffer.
A whiff sniffer.
And
and again the actor's creed, "The show must go on," had been given further proof, not in a novel, not in a play, but in a really true behind-the-mic story. January was played by January himself, Pick Malone. Molasses was impersonated by Ward Wilson. Be sure to listen next week when I will talk with NBC News commentator Fred Bates, who will tell you from London how he gets the news he broadcasts, and more of the human interest, the glamour, the comedy and the drama that are found behind the mic. This is Graham McNamee speaking. Good afternoon, all.
Behind the Mic is written by Mort Lewis. Original music written and conducted by Ernie Watson. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Behind the Mic on Tuned to Yesterday from the 24th of November, 1940 on the NBC Blue Network. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now a syndicated episode of the program That Was the Year, profiling the events of 1928. This episode released for broadcast in 1935.
That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
That was the year. Sing Sing Prison, Ossining, New York, January 12. An ominous, portentous silence, broken only by the pacing of nerve-racked men, pervades the grim, gray rows of impregnable cells. Climactically, at 11:14 p.m., the lights flicker.
There it goes. There goes the second one.
Father, for they know not what they do. Forgive them, Father.
Fight down, you lads. Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!
And the condemned men along death row knew that within 14 minutes, the hot seat had taken the mortal lives of numbers 79891 and number 79892. That Ruth Brown Snyder, 33, and Henry Judd Gray, 34, had paid the extreme penalty for the killing less than a year before of the woman's husband, Albert Snyder. Upon the day previous to the executions, dapper corset salesman Gray had made a statement.
I did it because Ruth wanted me to. I had no part in the insurance, and I had no reason to think that the death of Snyder would make any difference in the affair that Ruth and I were having. As a matter of fact, I was a little tired of that. But I had agreed with Ruth to go through with it, and I did. I say this knowing that I have no chance to escape my penalty. Knowing that Ruth has been doing everything she could to make it appear that it was all my fault.
1928. That was the year.
Daytona Beach, Florida, February 19. Thundering down these hard white sands in his 12-cylinder Bluebird today, British World War ace Captain Malcolm Campbell broke the former record of Major H.O.D. Seagrave, setting the new and astounding record of an average of more than 206 miles per hour in an automobile.
That was the year.
March 13. At about 1 a.m. in a ranch house near Piru, California, in the valley of the Santa Clara River.
Ben. Ben.
What's the matter?
Wake up, Ben. Listen.
What's the trouble? It's raining, that's all.
Ben, I'm afraid.
Oh, now, there's nothing to worry about, honey. You've seen rain before.
But I've never seen anything like this rain before. The water's up around the house, Ben.
Huh? How do you know?
I just looked out of the window.
Well, maybe I better get out and see what it's doing to...
Ben, listen. What's that noise?
Come on, Ben. We got to get out of here. It's a St. Francis dam. It's busted.
Oh! boiling 12 billion gallons of water into the Santa Clara Valley, a wall of water from Losangba's reservoir swept everything before it. Fruit trees, vineyards, homes, ranch houses, inundated the towns of New Hole, Ventura, Oxnard, Santa Paula, Fillmore, Moore Park, Piru, and others. Killed 450 persons.
1928. That was the year.
Between April 13 and September 18 of this year, a series of events of major import in the history of aviation occurred.
April 13.
Flying from Dublin, Ireland, a German transatlantic plane, the Bremen, lands out of commission at Greenlee Island, north of Newfoundland.
3 days later, April 15.
Captain George H. Wilkins and Lieutenant Carl B. Eilson fly across the Arctic Circle from Point Barrow, Alaska, to Spitsbergen, Norway, in 20 hours and 20 minutes.
April 23.
Floyd Bennett and Bernd Balken take off from Detroit with supplies for the stranded German aviators of the Bremen. A few minutes before he took to the air, said Bennett,
I feel rotten. I think I'm going to die.
Stricken with pneumonia, he was rushed by plane to a Quebec hospital. Hearing of Bennett's serious illness, his friend Richard Evelyn Byrd rushed to his side, while Colonel Charles Lindbergh loaded serum on his plane, dashed to Quebec, there to learn that the serum was incorrect and that his dramatic journey had been in vain. 2 days later, April 25, Floyd Bennett died.
May 25.
General Umberto Nobile, after dropping the Italian flag and an oaken cross blessed by the Pope upon the North Pole, crashes in his dirigible airship Italia. A mechanic was killed. Nobile and two companions were injured. Almost immediately, the ship reascended, carrying six men to an unknown doom.
June 18.
Venerable explorer Roald Amundsen, discoverer of the South Pole, leaves Tromsø, Norway, heading a party of six on their way to rescue Nobile. Amundsen and his companions were never heard from.
June 24.
Nobile was rescued by Swedish aviator Lundberg.
May 31.
The monoplane Southern Cross, commanded by British Captain Kingsford Smith, flies over the Golden Gate, heads west toward Hawaii, lands at Wheeler Field, Oahu, shortly after midnight the next day. Thence, Kingsford Smith pilots his plane to Australia, landing at Sydney, June 13.
June 3.
Amelia Earhart and Wilma Stoltz leave Newfoundland for a transatlantic flight to England. Land at Burryport, Wales, 21 hours, 11 minutes later.
September 18.
Juan de la Cierva pilots his autogyro in the first long-distance flight of a helicopter from London to Paris.
April 13 to September 18, 5 months of air history.
The men of the Bremen, Wilkins, Eilson, Bennett, Kingsford, Smith, Balken, Lindbergh, Byrd, Nobile, Amundsen, Earhart, Stoltz, de la Cierva, heroic names all, intrepid explorers of the boundless frontiers of space.
...1928. That was the year.
London, May 22.
This day, the House of Lords passed a bill giving to all women the right to vote upon attaining the age of 21.
23 days later, on June 14, a 69-year-old Englishwoman died. Her life's work accomplished. Mrs. Emmeline Pankhurst, ardent leader of the women's suffrage movement in England, many times incarcerated for her militant activities, had witnessed 10 years before the passage of a bill granting the right to vote to all women over the age of 30. Now, her final goal had been achieved. Victory was the reward of Mrs. Pankhurst, and following a brief illness, she left in death the glory of triumph to her two daughters and her devout colleagues.
...1928. That was the year.
Paris, France, August 27. While uniformed, steel-helmeted army reserves patrol the Quai d'Orsay to prevent further outbursts of communists, a stern-visaged group of diplomats gathered in the Salle d'Horloge, the famous clock room of the French Foreign Ministry Office. At approximately 3:45 p.m., Foreign Minister Aristide Briand turns to German Foreign Minister Gustav Stresemann.
Dr. Stresemann, please say.
Danke.
For the United States of America, Mr. Kellogg.
Yes. Thank you.
Oh, excuse me. This pen doesn't seem to... I'll try again.
Pardon, monsieur. I will wipe off the ink. Voila.
Thank you.
After struggling with a quill pen used by his countryman, Benjamin Franklin, a century and a half previously, U.S. Secretary of State Frank B. Kellogg became the second representative of 15 nations to sign the Briand-Kellogg Treaty through the preamble and three articles. The high contracting parties agreed
that the settlement or solution of all disputes or conflicts shall never be sought except by pacific means.
In the light of successive international events, you who listen may wonder why certain nations, the ultimate 60 you signed, became signatories to such a seriously humane document.
Germany and France, Italy and Ethiopia, China and Japan, and Spain.
1928, that was the year
that pulchritude became a drug on the cinematic market, that producers of motion pictures lost interest in classic male profiles and feminine beauty in their frantic search for the pear-shaped tones of luscious voices. For the big bad monster sound had entered the movies, had upset the apple cart of fabulous salaries, placed a premium upon the ability to sing a song or speak an intelligible line of English.
And that was the year
that one of the most amazingly prodigious cycles of popular music production gave to the world those two best-selling songs.
In dreams I kiss your hand, Anna, your dainty fingertips. And while in summerland, Anna, I'm begging for your lips. I haven't any right, madame, to do the things I do. Just when I hold you tight, madame, you vanish with the night, madame. In dreams I kiss your hand, madame, and pray my dreams.
The bird with feathers of blue is waiting for you.
Back in your own backyard,
you'll see your castle in vain through your window pane.
Back in your own backyard,
or you can go to the east or to the west, but someday you'll come. Weary as heart, back we started from. You'll find your happiness lies right under your eyes.
Back in your own backyard,
the bird with feathers of blue is waiting for you.
Back in your own backyard,
you'll see your castle in vain through your window pane.
Back in your own backyard,
or you can go to the east, go to the west, but someday you come. Weary of heart, back we started from. You'll find your happiness lies right under your eyes.
Back in your own backyard,
in your own backyard.
That was the year on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated episode from 1935. Among the narrator Gerald Moore's earliest radio work, he was 21 years old at the time of that broadcast, and he also starred in a now obscure series called Anne of the Airlines in that same year. Later in his radio career, he would go on to be very famous on the air in The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, where he was the leading man. We wrap up this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday with a 1950 episode of The Passing Parade from the Armed Forces Radio Service, the story of Morrow Castle.
The Passing Parade, your favorite stories as told by your favorite storyteller, a man whose voice is familiar to millions of theatergoers and radio listeners. Here's John Nesbitt to bring you some stories from The Passing Parade.
An ancient unwritten law of the sea holds that if a ship strikes disaster, the captain is always to blame. This is a heartbreaking rule in many cases, and it smashed the careers and lives of thousands of brave and innocent men. An accident at sea, and unless the explanation offers overwhelming evidence on the other side, the skipper is washed out. He's beached for life. The iron-hard court-martials of the Navy are based upon this principle, that come storm or hurricane, tidal wave, or fire or iceberg, the captain is to blame. He can erase the accusations best in one way, to grip like a vice on the quarterdeck rail and go down with his sinking ship. And behind this ruthless tradition, there lies some terrible memories. The Morro Castle disaster is an example of recent times. No seagoing vessel was ever made that was any better or safer than the men who sailed her. The Morro Castle met death in the morning of September the 8th in 1934. 137 people were drowned or burned alive. Yet the Morro Castle was an honestly built ship. She was one of the world's most up-to-date vessels. She was appointed like a floating Waldorf Astoria. She had a fortune's worth of automatic devices to put out fires. She was carefully inspected and carefully operated. She had 318 passengers and a full crew of 240. If you like being superstitious about the sea, you have evidence here to imagine that what struck the Morro Castle was a mysterious jinx and not merely the shortcomings of men. For in September of 1933, the castle was caught in a hurricane off Cape Hatteras and all but turned turtle. And 2 months later, her ill fortune led her to be cruising off Cuba just at the time that a revolution burst out, and she was caught in the crossfire between gunboats and a shore battery and scarred with explosive shells. No sooner had her owners made repairs for these two events when, under mysterious circumstances, her cargo twice caught fire. In both cases, they were promptly put out, but they were one reason why, on the night of September the 7th in 1934, she had some of the most modern fire detection systems in existence. During the captain's dinner party that evening, Captain Wilmot suddenly fell ill and fainted. Taken to his cabin, he sank deeper into a coma. And as the orchestra began playing foxtrots for the main dance of the cruise, word was brought to the passengers that Captain Wilmot was dead. One of the neatly uniformed, ordinary seamen on deck now remarked again that the Jinx was still sailing, and it was no good for the Morro Castle to dock always at Pier 13 when she reached home port. And there was real sorrow as well as shock among the passengers when the death of Captain Wilmot was announced, for he was a friendly and easygoing man. Yet, as he was a sailor, it is more than possible that Wilmot would have thanked death for sparing him the next 20 hours that he might have lived through. It was quite foggy that night with a choppy sea, and inside the public rooms of the handsome vacation cruiser, however, the decorations were still in place, dozens of balloons floating against the ceiling, bright streamers crisscrossed from the lighting fixtures. Although most of the passengers, honeymooners in brand new clothes, or office workers who'd saved for years for this cruise, were avid for a good time, they put on a respectable solemnity in the presence of the death of the captain. By the hour of 2 in the morning, virtually all the revelers had gone silently to bed. Some of them stayed up a few more minutes to pack their bags, for the Morro Castle docked promptly at noon next day in New York. At 42 minutes after 2 a.m., a crew member on the night watch ran across the deck and climbed up to the captain's bridge. Up there, behind plate glass, snug and calm as he puffed his pipe and peered out into the fog, was First Officer William Worms. The instant the captain had drawn his last breath, it was William Worms who became the man to blame, the man whose life was tied up with the life of this ship. The able-bodied seaman from below hauled himself up, and half out of breath, he said, "Smoke and sparks coming in from a port ventilator amidship, sir." First Officer Worms took it calmly, as was his duty, and quietly turned to the second-in-command, Officer Hackley. "Investigate it at once, please." Officer Hackley disappeared down the ladder right after the seaman. Below, he discovered the cause of the sparks. A fire was blazing in the dainty little writing room, decorated for passengers by a leading furniture firm in New York. The elaborate fire alarm system hadn't been installed in these public rooms, where fire at sea virtually never originates. The paneling of the walls was blistered by the heat, and the draperies were flaring up brightly. That was the little fire that killed the Morro Castle and tortured 137 humans to their deaths as well. What follows aboard this doomed luxury vessel is the ancient story of unbelievable human error, unbelievable heroism, and it adds another cause for the tradition that so seldom forgives the master of the ship for a single error.
That's the first half of John Nesbitt's story on today's Passing Parade. While he's preparing his notes for the second portion, let's listen to some music from Victor Young.
Oh,
again is John Nesbitt to continue his story on The Passing Parade.
On the reviewing stand once more, when from the bridge of the Morro Castle, the first alarm went out at about 2:47 a.m., fire all watches on deck, the crew came on the run. The crew came with such haste that not a man stopped as they shot past sets of heavy open doors of steel. Those doors were fire doors, carefully designed to divide the ship into flame-tight compartments. But they were not closed. But with all this speed, the men were already too late. For in the fancy little writing room, the flames had eaten through the painted ceiling. There was an airspace between this ceiling and the steel deck above. The deck should have stopped the flames, and perhaps not a passenger would ever have learned of the trouble. But alas for them, one of the prides of the Morro Castle was its air conditioning. It had been designed to keep passengers cool in the tropics, so a multitude of air shafts and ventilators ran like great blood vessels through the mass of the ship. And through these tubes, the heat and flame began to race, as if blown by a hurricane. At 56 minutes past two, rigid now, First Officer Worms jerked the levers that would send the alarm shrieking through the ship. He did so just 14 minutes after that worried seaman had poked his head above the bridge. The passengers awoke and slid to their feet and opened their cabin doors. The corridors were already furnaces. They were giant-sized tubes drawing that gale of flame through the ship. And the rest of the story can only be told in flashes of fire, in searing glimpses remembered afterward by those who lived through the night. There were 12 good lifeboats available. 8 of them were finally launched. But out of 318 passengers, only 85 reached safety. It requires a superbly trained crew and constantly drilled passengers to make full use of all the lifeboats in a panic. And this was a pleasure cruiser. The drills were not adequate. As each of these lessons came home, dozens of people died, as they always have, when a trifling carelessness turns into catastrophe. Crouched over his radio equipment, Chief Radio Operator George W. Rogers did his duty. And that duty was to wait for captain's orders before sending out the SOS. Here's another tradition of the sea, clad in iron. The captain must, in his judgment, delay the SOS for as long as is reasonable. For even if he overcomes the trouble, once the SOS is out, half the value of the ship and cargo goes to the first rescue vessel to arrive. And the first officer waited too long. For 20 minutes, Rogers agonized there in the radio room, with his fingers on the key, and no order came. Twice, Rogers sent his assistant operator to the captain for orders. No orders were given. At 3:15 a.m., Rogers sent the CQ, the clear-the-air signal, and he did so on his own responsibility. And when at 3:24 the order at last came from the captain, Rogers was holding a wet towel to his face, his equipment scorched and aflame. With an emergency transmitter, he sent out the three letters SOS. They circled out through the fog-bound sky just once. Morro Castle, a fire, 20 miles south of Scotland Light. S-O-S. At 29 minutes past three, the lighting plant failed, darkness fell, and chaos turned itself loose. Human beings were seen in the flashes of flame crawling by on all fours. Others were huddled without moving, praying quietly. At 4 a.m., a 26-foot motorboat manned by 5 Coast Guardsmen roared toward the burning ship. Out of the water came hands and arms clutching at the hull. In 5 minutes, the little powerboat was in danger of foundering, and her skipper was obliged to reverse his engines and pull away from the other arm stretched up from the water. He made for a Luckenbach liner 2.5 miles away, unloaded his half-conscious passengers, and roared back to the funeral fire that was once the Morro Castle. The 5 boys of the Coast Guard in their tiny craft saved 112 lives that night. Dawn broke out on the New Jersey shore in the morning, and along the beaches, men and women from the Morro Castle, who happened to be good swimmers, dragged themselves up on the sand and collapsed, gasping out thanks to God. Other human forms reached the beach that morning, but they were corpses carried in on the tide. Empty lifeboats, bright patent leather suitcases, fine tennis rackets, and dozens of curios and souvenirs that had been purchased during the wonderful vacation to the south. The beach was littered with all of these things. When the corpse of the Morro Castle herself was towed into the Asbury Park Pier, with First Officer Worms and 13 of his crew staying with her, as was their final obligation, a kind of shameful thing took place. 350,000 people came to the beach and pier to watch and look at the smoking ruin. The concessions opened especially for the occasion, even though it was winter, and did $500,000 worth of business. As such men must in this profession, First Officer Worms and the chief engineer stood investigation and trial. They were sentenced to prison for incompetence. 3 years later, they were released when it was satisfactorily proved that the long-dead captain had been too friendly and too easy a man. He had failed to maintain the unending discipline which might have tuned his officers to a point where they would not have failed in disaster. Congress launched an investigation, and today there are sprinkling systems in every quarter of our American ships and dozens of other invisible safeguards, all stemming from that investigation. And for each one of these new devices, men and women died at sea on the night of September 7th and 8th in 1934, when a good ship sailed into the inferno.
You have been listening to your favorite stories as told by America's favorite storyteller, John Nesbitt. Be with us the next time we move to the reviewing stand for yet another glimpse of The Passing Parade. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.
The Passing Parade, on Tuned to Yesterday, an Armed Forces Radio Service broadcast from 1950, bringing to a close this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeBounier. Thanks for tuning in.